to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories. Hi everyone, in this week's episode, Mel and I sat down with Jess. She's a mother of four living in regional Victoria. Jess has a really unique VBAC story to tell us. Her first birth was a vaginal birth in a private hospital setting. The fairly positive birth experience was somewhat overshadowed when doctors discovered her newborn daughter had a rare connective tissue disorder. Despite the challenges presented by her eldest diagnosis, Jess really embraced motherhood, and she was thrilled to discover that she was pregnant with twins. When one twin was found to be breech, Jess agreed to a planned cesarean for her second birth. Her fourth child and third birth was a VBAC journey that she undertook through her local public hospital in the MGP program. It was also during COVID in 2020. In between each of her three births, Jess experienced three miscarriages, and she shares the very personal grief of these with us. I feel what Jess shows is a refreshing blend of positivity as well as resilience as she describes what it's like to raise a child with additional needs and to navigate the usual and not so usual trials of parenting. So thank you, Jess, for sharing your story with us, and we do hope that you all enjoy this episode.
Jess, thank you so much for coming onto the show to share your own VBAC journey with us. We'd love to start. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, we'd love to start by asking you to just tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm Jess. I live in regional Victoria with my husband and four kids, the youngest of which you'll be able to hear a little bit because she's with me right now. She's 3 months old. At the moment, aside from looking after all the kids, work a bit from home as well, doing some admin tasks and some kind of casual work for the local uni. Yeah. So my eldest has just turned 7 and she was my firstborn. Then I had twins 2 years later. So when my oldest had just turned 2, the twins arrived, boy-girl twins. And then the last little one, she was 4 years after the twins. So my twins, they were born via C-section, and so my latest addition is my successful VBAC.
Before you fell pregnant the first time with your eldest, did you have any preconceived notions about birth and pregnancy, or had you always imagined that you wanted to go down that path?
So before having kids, I worked full-time as a primary school teacher, and in my 20s, I guess I always knew that I would have a family or hoped I would in the future, but I wouldn't have really known what that would look like in terms of how many or when I would start. Or I actually, my husband and I have been together since we were 16, so yeah. High school sweethearts and stuff, yeah. And we're both moved off to uni and did our own thing for a bit, but yeah, kind of grown up together. And even though we got married in I was 26, you know, it wasn't, you know, you get that, oh, kids, When are the kids coming? We weren't super keen to get started straight away. We wanted to travel and just work and enjoy freedom, which I now look back. So when we did get pregnant with our first, yeah, the story back then was it was quite easy. We anticipated that it would maybe take a year or so, and it didn't for us. So we were kind of surprised pleasantly, but also a bit, this is earlier than we expected. Yeah, and I guess my ideas of birth and pregnancy back then was just, you know, well, everyone does it, so it's obviously, it should be achievable. I was pretty sporty and fit and healthy too, so, and I was naively innocent on what birth was, but I definitely had a really overly optimistic attitude that, oh, well, if other people can do it, of course I'll be able to. And I joke now, but I likened it to the fact that I've done half marathons and, you know, I'm really good endurance and so all these things that actually don't apply that much to childbirth, but I thought was putting me in pretty good stead.
I do talk about that pain in labour as being the same as
a marathon as sort of pacing yourself in the same way.
So those are us, like we have not done marathons and we're saying we've run a marathon.
Yeah,
I guess the mentality of backing yourself for the long haul is maybe the comparison. Yeah. But yeah. In terms of discomfort or pain or even just longevity of childbirth, it's just different. It's not something you can compare. And
yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to the chat today because my firstborn, vaginal birth, and then twins via Caesar in the middle, and then a final vagina birth, they were just so different, the experiences. Both were good in their own ways. But yeah, it's interesting now having the space of time and my own personal growth and experience, but also expectations, all of that shift in the 7 years between the births, as we'll talk about coming up. I had a big shift in the model of care that I pursued for my final pregnancy.
You went private for the twins and your first pregnancy.
Yeah.
Did you want to take us to your first pregnancy and birth, and how did things unfold with your eldest?
I had such an amazing pregnancy. I didn't have any niggles. I was fit and healthy the whole way through. I saw a private obstetrician and I was talking to my husband last night about why did we go private back then? And one of the reasons, it sounds so silly now, but as a young 30-year-old, which I was at the time, or 29, you know, I was afraid of having pap smears and stuff back then. No one had ever looked, you know, at my body in that depth, and I wasn't comfortable with that. And so I sought out the only female obstetrician in our area at the time because I thought I needed a female, I guess. That was my perspective back then. We thought going private meant that we had that continuity of care. But as it panned out, because I was so well in my pregnancy and there were no risk factors and just everything was traveling along so well, when I would have my appointments at the obstetrician's private rooms, I would actually end up seeing the midwife, which I quite enjoyed because they were longer and you could have a chat. And when it came to the delivery side of things, my daughter was born on the weekend and they have that rotating roster. So my obstetrician wasn't on that weekend, so I had a different OB anyway at the birth.
Did you know that there was a chance this obstetrician wouldn't be available if you did give birth on the weekend?
Yeah, I did. And again, I was just naively confident and things, and I think I just thought, oh, what are the chances?
Yes.
But I can tell you now, the chances, I've had three births all on the weekend, so
there you go.
And I also figured, what's the difference, they're all a team, they'll hand over notes. And I've since, meeting other parents as well in the local area, everyone's got stories to tell about particular obstetricians and their preferences, and I realize how different they are. Whereas back then I thought they're all an obstetrician, they must have the same kind of approach, and now I understand that that's not the case.
So do you want to tell us about how the birth unfolded? Did you go into labour spontaneously?
Yeah, I did. She was actually born on midday on her due date, 40 weeks exactly. I was just feeling tightenings and they kind of amped up a bit. And then I remember on the Saturday afternoon, I called the hospital and said, you know, what do I need to watch for before I come in? And they mentioned like mucus plug and stuff like that. And I remember I must have lost my plug like at Saturday night about 10 o'clock. And at that point, I thought I was getting some really intense tightenings and stuff, and I thought I was having pretty big contractions. And I'd done a calm birth course and I thought I was managing everything really well, and I was expecting to go into hospital and have the staff go like, oh, my gosh, you're 8 centimetres dilated. Wow, how have you managed at home for so long? And then I got in and I wasn't that far along at all. I went in about midnight on the Saturday night. The obstetrician came and examined me and then said, all right, we're back in the morning at like 8 o'clock. I just remember saying to my husband, like, what happens between now and 8 o'clock? Looking back, I probably could have tried to relax or have a sleep or something, but I just thought I was, when you don't know where the finish line is, you know, you think you're nearly there. And with that first birth, I think I just had no idea how long things take to progress with your first, and because you haven't felt it before, it's such a, you know, intense and different feeling. About 8 or 9 o'clock, I think, they moved me into a birthing suite, and so she was posterior as well, which I didn't really get told about until like a bit later on when she was showing a bit of fetal distress. But I had a different obstetrician come in, so because it was the weekend. So an obstetrician I hadn't met before. He's just retired now. Definitely when the shifts were changing between midwives and stuff, I could overhear kind of talk about this particular obstetrician, and I don't think they saw eye to eye that perhaps he was a bit old school, and there was talk that he was kind of quick to go to Caesar. And I had a lot of different midwives kind of saying to me, do you want a natural birth? And I'm saying yes. And so then they're actually giving him different measurements for how much I dilated and stuff, because I think they were concerned that he would have thought I hadn't progressed quickly enough and then might have wanted to do a Caesar. So looking back now, though, I don't know, it was really awkward, really, thinking that people weren't on the same page. And my belief back then was, yes, I'll try for a natural birth, but I'll be guided by the professionals, is what my perspective was back then. Now, after having a few more experiences, I realise that people guide you based on their experience and their preference, and that too, it might not always align with what you're hoping.
It turned out you were in labour for quite a long time with your first, and you weren't making steady progression. Did you access any pain relief?
I didn't want any pain relief, but in the end I did go for some gas. And then in the very final stages, when I guess she was kind of stuck, they then all of a sudden were like, oh, we need to give you a spinal block because I was too far. They couldn't do the epidural, and I think they must have realised they needed to use forceps. I remember them trying to do the spinal block and trying to find a break between my contractions to do it. And at this point, because I was trying really active labour, I was walking around the whole time and I wanted to be upright. And at this point, my legs, a bit like a marathon, were completely shaky, and I was finding it really hard to be still enough for them to do the spinal
block. Did you ask for the epidural, Jess, or was it offered to you?
That's a great question. I think, I don't believe I asked for it. The obstetrician really kind of became assertive and said, we need to get this baby out now, and like, this is what we have to do. And I remember looking at my husband and saying to him, what do we do? And he just said, yep. I think he's a real numbers guy, statistician. He's the partner who loves timing contractions and stuff. And he works in health. So seeing the monitor, I think at that point they had the baby's heart monitored and he was seeing the heart rate drop and that. So he was also like, yes, let's do what we're being advised to do. I was happy overall, but I remember them telling me to push. And because I couldn't feel anything, I was like, I think I'm pushing. I don't know. I think I am. And it was a weird feeling because I was really trying to like play my role in pushing, but I just couldn't tell what effect I was having. I do know that I had an episiotomy for that one. They had to do a little cut. Yeah, my daughter was born with the use of forceps. Even though I was so active, that last final moment, of course I was relieved to have our baby born and everything be okay, but I've just got this like weird vision of me looking across to my right and there was a mirror and I could see the obstetrician there and like my legs up in the air and him sewing, you know. This kind of, just this weird feeling of looking across and kind of being like, oh, that's, yeah, that image that it looks like I'm seeing a picture on a wall, but that's actually real life, but I have no sensation.
Me in my body.
Then I remember it was, you know, wonderful looking across and seeing my husband holding our daughter, and then we just had a few hours, like we didn't call family and tell anyone anything, and we just couldn't believe where that time went, just us with our baby. And then I remember, though, like into the evening, because she was born at midday, saying to my husband, like, oh, I still can't feel my legs. This is weird. I want to walk around. And anyway, the feeling came back. And so even though we have family that live in town, we just said to them, oh, your grandchild's been born, because we didn't know if we're having a boy or a girl. And so that was awesome. The grandparents coming up to the hospital and us saying, like, here's your granddaughter, and telling them her name. And, you know, the mum and dad said that that was a great trip, going to the hospital and saying to each other, what do you think? Do you think it's a boy? Mm-hmm. What do you think the name will be? So that was a nice little surprise, but I was just lying in bed for that. You know, I couldn't walk up and pass my baby over to my parents at that point in time.
in that, I guess, postpartum period, what were your reflections on the birth? And did you have any thoughts in your mind about what you might want to do next time?
Yeah. So overall, I felt like it was positive. You know, I felt like I had had a natural birth. Yes, there was a bit of intervention. Time went on. I can look back, and particularly when I got around to thinking about upcoming births, I had my questions about how things were handled on the day, but the birth wasn't traumatic. I had some great midwives who for periods of time came in and were brilliant, and I had a great rapport with them, and I really loved, you know, how they kind of cheered me on. And I did leave that birth period feeling like it was success. And then what was probably the biggest difference for us in that postpartum experience was the next day when our daughter was about 20 hours old, I just noticed a bit of blue on her upper lip. And I called the nurse in just to ask them to check. You know, she was like, oh, I'm sure it's fine. I'll just get the sats and check her oxygen levels. And at that point, my husband had just gone out to get a few extra supplies. She was in our room with us, our baby. And then fairly quickly, a few other staff members came in and they were like, oh, we might just take her into the special care room for a moment. And at this point, I was like, oh, is everything okay? And they're like, yeah, should be. Just where's your husband? And I said, oh, he's just gone out. And they said, oh, it'd probably be a good idea if he came back now. And then I was still trying to gauge. I was like, how now? He just has to get some things. Should he still get the things? And I was a bit, does he get them and then come back, or does he come back now? And they were like, no, get him to come back now. I'm like, okay. So then he came back, and then, you know, that by this point they called the head pediatrician in, and yeah, they worked out something was happening with her heart function. So they organised for pediatric transfer down to the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne for us. And at this point I was still kind of like, you know, is this serious or not? You know, I was a bit vague, I guess, around it all. And I just remember one of the lovely midwives, because I had to be discharged at that point, so to head to Melbourne with our daughter. But another reason, back if I think about why we chose private care, was originally we were like, oh, it'll be good to stay in hospital for a few days. And, you know, as first-time parents, we can focus on our baby and learn how to breastfeed, and we don't know what we're doing, so it'd be great to just have different midwives come in and we can take and leave bits of advice they give us. So that was another reason we kind of thought we'll have this hospital stay. Yeah, so we were discharged when she was like less than 24 hours old, and I remember the nurse kind of saying to me, I know you're worried about your baby and your husband's gone in the ambulance with your baby, but, you know, and her giving me a quick rundown, like, here's some pads, you'll probably bleed, you know, and trying to give me a quick kind of post-birth 101. Yeah, so that was kind of a weird experience. And then being down at the Children's Hospital for a few days, like, and my milk was coming in down there, and, you know, it's all a blur because the focus was on the baby, you know, rightly so. But then, funnily enough, I still got to focus on breastfeeding because I couldn't feed her and I really wanted to be able to give her breast milk. So I actually got the lactation consultant to come up to the ward. And so I kind of still got my breastfeeding coaching in that way. And after about 5 days, must have been a maternal nurse, she came in and just kind of said to me, everything okay with you post-birth? And I was like, I think so. Still kind of hurts to sit down a bit. You know, is that normal? And I had an infection in my stitches and stuff like that, which I didn't, again, first time birth and not being checked regularly, I just thought, oh, this is what happens for a few days. So anyway, that was all okay. And, you know, they were able to diagnose what was happening with my daughter and link us in with early intervention. And, you know, we got home about a week later, and our perspective at that point was just, we're so thrilled to have our baby with us that kind of the specifics of the birth didn't matter as much.
So what was the diagnosis that they gave you at that point in time?
Well, they had to do some genetic testing, but yeah, they were fairly certain down the Children's Hospital. They had a geneticist come in, and he was able to say, even before you get the confirmation, yeah, we know that she has a connective tissue disorder. So they were able to let us know that straight away. And we left the hospital with her with cardiac medications and a hip brace, because they were able to screen really early and see that she had hip dysplasia. So she wore a hip brace for quite a short period of time in comparison to kids that's discovered later. Yeah, and so from that moment, we've been linked in with early childhood intervention and have had a great support team around us, and we're still heavily involved with the hospital there. So it's interesting because when I was listening last year in my fourth pregnancy to your podcast, a lot of the women would talk about some kind of negative hospital experiences or where they maybe trust might have been eroded with the medical system and things like that. We have a very different experience in our LinkedIn with public health in the state of Victoria, you know, has been quite amazing. We've had amazing experts helping us with our daughter. So we feel quite trusting of the system in that regard.
Absolutely, it's interesting you say that because I feel sometimes when you do require sort of specialist intervention that you do come across these really remarkable individuals who are doing their best and who you can see are sort of genuinely interested in helping the baby and helping you. And it is in stark contrast to a lot of those negative stories that we do hear. And occasionally I've heard negative stories about NICU, but my experience of NICU was that the staff were just phenomenal human beings. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Particularly, it sounds like you were in quite a stressful situation, not knowing what was going on. Those people were your source of comfort and your source of information and guidance. Were you told anything at that time about what that would mean for your child's development later on? Any outcomes, you know, in terms of as she got older, or is that just a still a work in progress?
Yeah, it's still a work in progress. It's kind of a rare condition. Thankfully, with internet, I've been able to connect with parents around the world with kids with a similar condition. And I guess the prognosis, the main thing is that they often, because the cardiac side's quite serious, we don't think far ahead, particularly back then. We couldn't believe we had a girl starting school and now have a seven-year-old. You know, medical science, like, is just amazing. Thank goodness there's some incredibly talented and smart people out there. It would have been a different story having a diagnosis like she has 20 or 30 years ago. I guess right from that moment, it changed the trajectory of our experience as parents changed, because even now when I know friends who will talk about their kids, you know, high school or driving or something like that, like those type of far out future thoughts is just a place that we don't really allow ourselves to go, because the daily stuff is great with our daughter. She's at school now and she's just amazing kid and always has been. But it's kind of a bit daunting to think about what the future might hold. So we just have our regular checkups and take it checkup by checkup. What they told us about a diagnosis wasn't great, but it was essentially, you know, I remember at one stage saying to a specialist, I was looking to go to work, or I said something about, you know, should we be concerned about daycare? And he was like, kids get so sick in daycare. Like, why would you? No, like, kind of don't look at daycare. And then so we didn't for her. And then we had twins when she was 2 years old. So it was like, well, we've got three kids, two and under. So daycare's not happening.
Did they tell you about her heart, what condition her heart was in?
They did. So it's all linked to her connective tissue disorder. And so her connective tissues are like really flexible or elastic, I guess. And she's had heart valve repairs when she was 2.5. The twins were 6 months old. She had her first open heart surgery then, and there'll be more in the future.
So it sort of sounds like it shaped a lot of your parenting decisions in a way, this diagnosis. So in terms of things like she couldn't be sent to daycare or exposed to sort of illnesses in that way. And did it make you always quite protective of her, I suppose, as well? Was there a stress surrounding that? Her health always?
Yeah, there was a bit. It's hard, but we kind of use that saying almost all the time, that be alert but not alarmed. We don't want to be living on like really high stress. But yeah, it was funny when, not funny is not the word, but last year when COVID hit in Victoria and everyone was suddenly, you know, being aware of not spreading illness, we were kind of like, you know, welcome to what we've been experiencing for
That's
years.
Right.
You know, you go to kinder and you hear a kid coughing and or you see the snotty nose, or you catch up with friends at the park and you see these kids and you're like, oh, what, you know, why did you bring your kid out like this? Like, it'll spread and, you know.
And because it could potentially be a lot more serious for your child, I guess.
Yeah.
The reality of that. Yeah. And it changes the way you approach those things.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So when you fell pregnant with the twins, this was 2 years after your first birth and your eldest diagnosis and that whole process. Firstly, finding out that you were pregnant with twins, was that a surprise? Were you excited about this pregnancy or was there a bit of trepidation there?
No, we were excited. In the initial stages of my eldest, you know, we took a while to discuss kids, like additional kids, because I think we knew we wanted them, but I had this, it's crazy to even think about now, but yeah, I had this real thought of what happens if I'm pregnant and something bad happens to our eldest and I'm pregnant with grief, you know, like I just, that was a real consideration for me, or like, you know, what happens if we've got hospital stays and then with our eldest and I've got a baby and, you know, we really have to think about all that type of stuff. I guess in the end, we just kind of went, well, those big things that might happen, or in our case, we kind of know they'll happen, but we don't know when, like hospital admissions and stuff like that. We just thought there's a lot of days in between and we know how much our firstborn added to our lives. And we thought, well, we think it'd be great for her to have a sibling. And so we never really had the chat about how many kids are we going to have. So when we went in and had the scan, and we had a scan at 12 weeks, you know, after my first baby, I kind of thought I'll do everything that I did prior to having kids, just with a baby in tow, you know, as you do when you, you haven't made that adjustment to parenthood yet. I was back playing netball and I was enjoying that, and I knew I was pregnant, but I hadn't told anyone. And we missed out on the finals, and I was about 11 weeks pregnant, and I went to go watch the finals a couple of weeks later. And it was just so funny then to be able to say to people, oh, yeah, I'm pregnant and there's two. And people are like, what? yeah, so we had actually at that point when I was about 11 weeks pregnant, my oldest was admitted to hospital. She had an RSV virus and I was still breastfeeding her. So she wasn't quite two. She's 1.5 maybe. And one of the nurses there said to me, yeah, I knew you were pregnant in that hospital stay because you look so tired. And I'm like, how about I looked tired because I was breastfeeding my 1.5-year-old?
That's right.
Yeah.
Like, in hospital for about 5 nights. But, yeah, she was all like, I picked up on that. I knew you were pregnant. Yeah, so we found out the scan, we were having twins. And, yeah, we were just really happy, I guess, because even though we hadn't had the conversation on how many, we probably both thought three would have been good. Mm. So the fact that it was twins, it was like, well, there's
two,
three.
Two for the price of one, really.
Yeah, done. And the twin pregnancy went really well. I was optimistic, hoping for a vaginal birth with the twins. I was actually going to go public at that point. I went to my GP. I was really wanting to just do shared care. And when I saw him when I was 8 weeks pregnant or something, I said, I'm happy to go public now. We went private before and didn't really feel like we got anything for pursuing a private pregnancy, you know, like not having our obstetrician follow us through, not even seeing her throughout the pregnancy, and our post-birth stuff being, you know, leaving the private hospital immediately, or, you know, that a day later. So the plan with my GP was that we would do shared care. And then he said, oh, unless you find out that you're having a multiple birth or some kind of complexity. So then I went back at 13 weeks and said, well, we're having twins. And I just took his advice. You know, now I would probably not necessarily do that. It wasn't bad advice, but I just said to him, what do you think? And he said, in the area that we live in, there's this particular obstetrician. He's an expert on IVF and multiple pregnancies. So why don't you see him? So I said yes. And we spoke about the potential to have a natural birth with twins. I think I had a 20-week scan or something and my twin A was breech. They just said it's unlikely the twin A will have the room to move because of twin B being on top of them. They were like bunk beds. I knew that. And then everything went fine. I was hospitalized for a little bit because they were worried about the growth discrepancy between twin A and twin B. As it turns out, they're just fraternal boy-girl twins. So they're just two siblings born at the same time. So of course they're different sizes. But they were worried about that. They thought twin B wasn't growing as well. Mm-hmm. So they had scheduled me for a Caesar at like 37 and 5. And I was thrilled when I went into labor on the Saturday morning, 36 weeks and 6 days, because at least my big thing about the Caesar was them getting plucked out when they weren't ready. So at least I felt when my water broke, okay, cool. they're coming out via a Caesar, but they must be ready, you know? Mm. That's what I told myself, yeah.
Were you at peace with the idea of having a cesarean by the end of the twins' pregnancy?
I was, because so twin A, and that's my son, and I remember one of the nurses saying to me, it's like this baby's sitting in there, like sitting in your pelvis like a beanbag. Mum is plugging. She goes, you're going to be a teenage boy just sitting on a beanbag playing PlayStation or something, you know? And it's so funny because, you know, I can see that the twin B, who is my daughter, what they told me, and, you know, I would probably discuss it more now, but back then they said, if a twin A happens to turn with twin B lying across the top, once that first twin comes out, then the other twin can be, you know, all of a sudden has got so much space to flip and turn and everything. So I probably was a bit scared of that too. So I did just kind of accept it and go, okay, well, you know, we're having a Caesar, but I was, yeah, really happy that my waters broke and that I'd got that far. They didn't need special care or anything. We'd planned for that in terms of recovery wise. We made a plan to have my husband home a little bit longer and, you know, obviously not being able to drive and all that type of stuff. So I was okay with it.
So did you want to take us to the birth, the cesarean and surgery, what happened when you were at hospital and what the care that you received, what that was all like?
Yeah, it was just exciting. Like, we got up into the hospital, you know, like towel between your legs. I'd been up there a fair bit in the lead up because they wanted to keep check fetal heart rates and stuff. I think it was might have been every third day at that point. So they knew us well. And my daughter, who was two, so she wasn't able to walk at that point. She used to have a little bike. So she'd, you know, ride her little like trike in there and, you know, press the lift buttons, and they all knew us. And so when we arrived on that day, it was kind of cool. People were like, oh, awesome. You know, you're here. It's the day. And everyone was excited. I had a 2-week stay. They put me on bed rest when I was about 30 weeks pregnant. So, you know, from that experience as well, there was certain stuff that I knew. And I was really excited to see that some of the midwives, the two that were on, so they were assigned because I was going in for a Caesar and they were twins, you know, they had a midwife each. There's a lot of people in the room for twin births. And I was okay with all that. And yeah, I just felt really excited, I guess. I didn't feel any contractions or anything.
And in the theatre, were you able to hold them straight away and have skin on skin? How did the procedure itself go?
Yeah. So since listening to your podcast, I wish I had engaged in that maternal assisted Caesar delivery stuff. I didn't even know about that.
Neither had I actually. It's not an option that's openly offered or spoken about.
Well, I think I wanted to counteract, you know, because in terms of being at peace with having the C-section, because I knew that was happening and I'd exclusively breastfed my firstborn and we'd had the skin-to-skin contact and everything, I was like, okay, well, if I have to have a Caesar, well, then I need to have the skin-to-skin and I'm going to breastfeed. And, you know, I always felt it was almost like this counteract that I wanted to achieve or something. So, yeah, I spoke to all the nurses about that going into theatre when my son came out. He was came out crying and everything, so everything was good with him and he was on my chest straight away. But then my daughter, I don't even really like looking at the photos of her birth because she looked really blue and floppy, and I just remember this sick feeling of being like, oh my, like she wasn't making a sound and just being like, what's happening? And then saying to my husband, because I had my son on my chest and my husband was with us, and I was just like, what's happening? Go over there. Like, and you know, it probably was quick, but it fit that time feels like forever. But then, yeah.
It feels like everything's happening in slow motion when you have.
Yeah. And then they were fine post-birth. They were skin to skin with me. Both of them were breastfeeding before I was even wheeled out. We had that amazing experience where they do that chest crawl and they both crawled down to, you know, a boob each. And
so you were able to tandem breastfeed from the beginning.
My daughter in particular found the nipple and I was just in awe because I was like, we're not even out of theatre, you know. Yeah, so that was great. And then, yeah, we didn't need special care stay. So then we did have that lovely private hospital experience because I had a Caesar and because I had twins. I stayed in, I think, for 5 nights and that was great. But I remember one night, the staff got busy all of a sudden, heaps of women came in labour and what they expected was a quiet night wasn't, and it was about 3 nights in and I had to manoeuvre the babies myself, whereas prior to that, if I needed to feed, I'd ring a buzzer and they'd come and help me set up, and then I was like, I can hear they're busy, this is my life now. I've got to work it out. I just kind of handled them probably a bit roughly or whatever, but got them on. And yeah, I just felt so excited once I had done that by myself. I thought, well, yeah, this is it. But I didn't always tandem feed. I ended up feeding them individually a lot as well.
That's amazing.
Were you also worried because of your eldest daughter and the conditions that she has? Was that on your mind within this pregnancy about your twins as well? And how?
No. See, it's funny. When I was pregnant the first time around, you know, you hear of things happening, things going bad, even pregnancy losses and stuff. And I just always had this feeling of like, oh, well, the majority of people have a good pregnancy to term and have birth and everything's fine. And I just assumed, well, of course I'll just be in that majority. After having the experience that we had with our firstborn, we then kind of realized, oh, this is a really rare condition. It's a genetic condition, but not passed on by my husband and I. It's just a spontaneous change in the genes. So then we were like, oh, okay, we are those people that have experienced a kind of really rare experience. And then when we were pregnant with twins again, we were like, oh, okay, that's also not, you know, it's common, but not run-of-the-mill.
Yeah.
But no, we did get referred to a genetic counsellor down at the Royal Women's Hospital in our twin pregnancy. And we didn't really kind of know what we were going there for, but we were like, oh, okay, we'll go along. And pretty much, I think they were expecting to have a conversation with us about whether or not we wanted to terminate the pregnancy. And, you know, within about 3 seconds of meeting, they were like, oh, so you guys are happy to continue, like, even if we detected the same condition as your eldest daughter? And we were like, yeah, we are. Our eldest daughter is like an amazing person. We love her to bits. You know, she's nothing wrong with her intellect or anything. She's just kind of a bit trapped in her physical body at times, but you know, she'll still do amazing things in life. Yeah. And so they were just kind of like, oh, okay, you don't really need genetic counseling. See ya. So then it never really entered our minds. Like, we were like, well, you know, I didn't even really think about it. I just thought it was so rare, the condition that our eldest has. And then we thought, well, if the others have that condition too, we know what to do. So it'll be okay.
So do you want to take us now to, I guess, falling pregnant with your last baby? Did you have in your mind that you wanted to have another baby, another pregnancy?
Yeah, I did. I think when our twins were about 2.5 or something, I kind of said to my husband, what do you think? Just, like, we were camping with my family, and, you know, the days were starting at 5 a.m. and I think he was just like, are you insane? And I was kind of like, I don't know if I want to either, but I just feel like we need to. I think having twins, one thing that did was that we never had that discussion, like a lot of people have two and then decide whether they have a third. We never had that discussion. It was like, okay, well, this is it. And then, yeah. So
I'm curious to know as well, did you feel at all that your age was playing a part in that decision-making process? Like, were you conscious of that at all? Or
Yeah, so much. And so this pregnancy that I've just had was my sixth pregnancy, but my third complete one. So definitely the more miscarriages I had as well. We told our family that we were having another baby, and the kind of joke was, let's just hope it's not twins, because that's a very real risk.
Oh, yes. Oh,
and with my age getting older, I was, you know, I was 37 when I had this fourth baby just now. So in the lead up, yeah, I think once you're 35, your class is geriatric and stuff. So I was like,
yeah, we're in the same boat.
Just yes, favorite word.
Yeah, I'm like, anyway, it was on my mind at my age. And funnily enough, I think as well, once you have your first, for some reason, I don't know if you guys are the same, but you have this thing of, oh, let's have babies 2 years apart, which what's really funny now that I've had a bigger gap between my youngest, the twins, and this baby, is that a bigger gap is amazing, because you're not dealing with toddler tantrums.
Yes.
They're actually helpful. They understand. You can play a game of cards with them. You can still meet their needs. It's very hard meeting the needs of a two-year-old with a baby. So I don't know why we all think that 2 years is an age gap to try to achieve.
I definitely agree with you. I just wanted to ask you, Jess, so did you have two losses or three losses?
Well, so I had three. I had a very early pregnancy loss before the twins. And at that point, I was upset to have a miscarriage, but I was like, one in four people have miscarriages. So this is my one miscarriage. It's sad, but I'll try again. And it'll, you know, that was the talk I was able to use to get through that, I guess. That whereas after I'd had the twins and then I had a miscarriage, I ended up in hospital, like in emergency. And I had this really beautiful nurse in emergency so most of the people when I went to emergency and I was losing a lot of blood, and I was probably driving the conversation a bit, I've got three kids, so, you know, like, I'm not allowed to be upset, or, you know, I'm thankful that I've got three kids kind of talk, and yeah, this is sad, but, you know, I should be grateful kind of thing. And then I had this one older nurse who would have been close to 60, and this is obviously pre-COVID. She just stopped me and gave me a cuddle and just said, it doesn't matter how many kids you've got, you've still lost one. And that really gave me, like, that really kind of, yeah. Because prior to that, they were talking about whether or not I needed a DNC. And I remember the doctor saying, oh, well, you know, she looks fine, like, emotionally. So let's just, like, see if she can kind of expel everything naturally and stuff. It was all kind of clinical talk, and I probably was on the surface, you know, quite matter of fact, or I was trying to be. And then when I had this nurse really kind of talk to me as a fellow mother, I found that really hard, that one, to get over. I shouldn't say get over, that's not even the right word, but to manage, because I actually hadn't told many people. Some of my family knew, but I hadn't, told a lot of people. And it was the physicality of it too. So I bled for quite a while. I just felt such a deep sense of loss. And I think that's where my husband said to me, because at that point I was saying, like, look, we tried. Maybe now the gap's too big between our kids, or I'm too old now. It's not like we didn't try. So maybe I just have to be happy with, you know, that's the cards we've been dealt, kind of. Conversation is what I was having. And then my husband was saying to me, I can see this is really had really impacted me. I found that really emotional period of almost a year. And then we decided that we would try again just before COVID hit. I had an early miscarriage. I was about 6 or 7 weeks. I'd had like a blood test, and then it was like a false alarm. I had a scan, an early scan for some reason, and they said, oh, there's no baby there. And I was like, okay. Because then my GP was like, oh no, your HCG levels are still high. Kind of hold on. You might've just had the scan too early. So I had this limbo of, you know, nearly a month waiting to see if I had a miscarriage or not. Yeah. So when we found out that I did, I remember this day, I just said to my husband, I'm out. And I went for this 3 or 4 hour bush walk. It was almost like I was punishing my body, like, you've done this to me three times now. Yes, I'm grateful that I've got three kids, but why, like, what is happening? Why can't you? I just punished myself, I guess. I think I just needed to just, you know, so much of the time, because I did have other kids, there's stuff I talked to them about, but I don't think they needed to hear that, you know, how do you explain, oh, mum's bleeding because a pregnancy isn't viable, or, like, you know, I kind of was... Yeah, certainly hiding my emotions from them. So there was a lot of shower crying and, you know, like crying at the end of the day and just feeling, I just felt just such a deep loss, I guess. I used to then talk to a lot of people, particularly twin mums, and say, did you know you were done? And people used to say to me, a lot of things was, two for one, isn't that great? No need to go again. And I was just really looking for people to just feel go away. Like,
and to say that it was okay to want another baby. Yes. Also that you were going through grief because of the miscarriages as well.
Yeah, definitely. And then when COVID hit, that was when I'd had this miscarriage last year, and COVID just hit, and then we were kind of, okay, well, all right, is this, what kind of a sign is this? Like, we're not religious or anything, but we were like, there's a global pandemic. Our daughter suffers from respiratory issues, the one who's got a chronic, you know, medical condition. We've just had a miscarriage. Maybe we're at capacity. Like, let's maybe. And then I just said to my husband, okay, if that's a decision we're making, I'm going to need to have some counselling over it, because I don't want to get to a point years on and regret that we didn't try again. So we were kind of having that chat, and then I know how it works. Yeah, surprise, surprise, my period never arrived, and it was like, what? So then we had this, amazing isolated COVID pregnancy where we were just really enjoying everyday moments with our little family and waiting for our final, I call her like the full stop when I say the kids' names in a row. That was the weird thing. I used to be in the shower and I'd say the names of my first three kids and I'd in my head I'd say their names and then there'd be an and a space. And now it's so good if I say my kids' names, I feel like there's a full stop at the end of number four.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Tell us about your pregnancy. You were mentioning before that you had changed your type of care, model of care. What spurred you on and was it a pretty easy decision this time?
Definitely. So there's the regional centre where I live, there's a midwife care program and it's supposedly for the kind of lower risk pregnancies and it's hard to get into. You get this one midwife for the whole pregnancy. You have to write a letter and a lot of people just, you know, don't get into the program. So I wrote this letter saying that, yes, I understand, like I'm wanting a VBAC and that might mean that I don't meet your criteria because it is considered a higher risk. But I also just wrote about how why I wanted the midwife care was that I needed a VBAC. I wanted one, but I needed one because I needed to get home with the whole COVID thing. I didn't want to be separate from my family. My eldest daughter has daily care need, but a bit of separation anxiety too. And I wanted to be home and involved in the care for all my kids as soon as I could be. And they got back to me straight away and were like, you're the prime candidate. We want to work with people who want VBACs. And I was like, oh, okay. I didn't have to sell my story.
That's great. So was it largely practical issues that were driving that decision?
Partly. Also in the pregnancy where I had the, you know, quite intense miscarriage, I'd gone up to hospital to visit a friend of mine who just had her third baby. When she just had this third baby, chatting to her a day after birth and her telling me her story and how amazing her birth was. And she was, you know, just so euphoric and ecstatic. And I was just sitting there with this wonderful secret of my own that I was about 8 or 9 weeks pregnant. And I was like, I'm going to get that. That's what I want. I want that conversation of just going, oh my gosh, I did this. And it was as much as I'd had the vaginal birth previously, probably the health concerns of my daughter
overshadowed
a lot of, And I was just like, oh, I just really want, you know, like this is my last shot. I really just want to have this amazing natural birth, drug-free, all this, and to feel how my friend felt. I just loved seeing her like that. So that was a big one. And then I also felt guilty because I was at different times. Have I pushed our family? My desire to want this experience of a really positive natural birth. Am I pushing our family beyond our capacity by having four kids, one with additional needs? You know, am I being selfish? Am I overpopulating? You know, just that was a big thought. Yeah, I try to counteract that too with different environmental decisions I make.
It's a valid thought, you know, and you're not
definitely
not isolated in that.
Yeah.
You know, it was innate within you, this desire to have another child. And it sounds like part of that as well was healing from the previous experiences and everything that you'd gone through and sort of moving on from that in a way.
Well, everyone talks about that feeling of feeling done. Even when I've listened to your podcast episodes I listened to last year and that, people would talk about that, like knowing that was it for them or whatever. And I used to always hear these conversations and go, I don't feel that. Why don't I? In some ways, I wish that I felt complete or finished. Yeah. And I had unfinished business. It was such a strong feeling and for me.
So you got into the midwifery practice program.
Yeah.
Did that mean you were able to have one midwife for the duration of that pregnancy?
Yeah. So I didn't meet anyone until I was about 23 weeks pregnant, which again was a kind of surreal experience. I didn't go for any scans because my GP said to me after that last experience that I'd had where, you know, it was kind of like in limbo, like I said, well, should I have scans or whatever? And he said, it depends on how anxious you'll be. If you're someone who has to know, then go and get scans and everything. And he said, but if you can be okay with just waiting and trusting your body and then just wait, don't have that information. And so I decided to do that. And I quite liked that, except that, as it got closer, you know, I was kind of like, okay, I'm past 20, I'm halfway now, and I've still not spoken to or seen anyone in person. Anyway, that all worked out fine. Once I met my midwife, I think I was about 23 or 24 weeks, and I just clicked with her immediately, and just, we had just a great chat about kids and life and birth and just positive. And I knew instantly she was what I needed, which was a coach from my sporting days. I needed someone to say, hey, Jess, you can do it and you're going to be amazing. And wow, like I just needed, yeah, I respond.
A cheer squad, yeah.
A cheer squad, totally, yeah.
And what was the rest of the pregnancy like from there?
Well, I felt my age. That's what I think. You know how you see like pregnant people waddling? Well, in the past, I used to be like, ah, oh, you know, they're exaggerating. You don't need to do that. I got the input of the women's health physio at the hospital because I was like, I think I've got pelvic girdle pain. And the load for me physically at home, sometimes my older daughter, I need to lift her places. And, you know, if we go on bushwalks, sometimes I carry her and things like that. And anyway, she just kind of got me on track with paying attention to how I was getting out of bed. And I didn't really make any adjustments for my pregnancy and in my day-to-day movements until that point. So yeah, after that, the rest of the pregnancy physically I was fine. And then when I got to about 34 weeks, I had the checkup with the obstetrician with my midwife there at the hospital. I was getting a lot of comments that I wasn't very big, just from, you know, members of the public. But I've got quite a big torso, so even with twins I didn't look huge. The obstetrician, they said to me at that point, oh gee, have you got your bag packed for hospital at 34 weeks? I said, oh, not yet. And she said, oh well, baby's head is down and ready to go. I wouldn't be surprised if this one, you know, came early. So I then was anticipating an early birth and on high alert, yeah, because I had one kid at school and then other kids at kinder. And, you know, I was kind of like really kind of conscious of where I was going every day and just that kind of mental load of every day, like, right, if it happens today, I'll call mum, you know, get my husband home from work. I always just had these constant plans. And yeah, as it worked out, I went overdue.
Oh, no.
It was past 40 weeks and then they were starting to talk about being induced and things like that. And I was like, oh, I wish, you know, 6 weeks ago I could have told myself, don't worry, there's no baby coming anytime soon.
I actually wanted to ask you about birth preparation as well. Did you do anything differently?
So the first birth I had, I did a calm birth course. And the difficulty of having had a vaginal birth before and then going for another one was all my naivety was gone. I knew that a vaginal birth was going to be tough. I knew that, you know, there was going to be pain. As much as I tried to tell myself, oh no, it's just sensation. And my first one doing the calm birth course, I really believed that breathing alone would get me through. And then in my fourth pregnancy, I thought, oh, I wanted to believe it, but I had this kind of like voice in my head going, ah, oh, but it didn't get you through last time. You needed, you know, you weren't able to do it on breathing alone. Like I was a bit fearful. I wanted to do it, but I was also like, I know what I'm getting in for. I ran into a friend who I don't see often, and she actually put me onto this lady in our local town who runs these empowered birth courses. And she had a course that was online because it was COVID stuff, and it was a VBAC masterclass. So I did that, and that just felt, and she actually was the one who said, listen to podcasts and whatever, and then I looked you guys up. So what I used to do heaps last year was just go for walks by myself, listening to your podcast, and I'd hear all the other women's stories of, you know, how labor progressed on that day. So particularly when I was told that, you know, expect prem labor with this baby, I'd be out in the bush walking, listening to you guys and different stories, and, you know, I'd hear how the birth unfolded for other people, and it just kind of gave me a good range of potential, like as in, okay, well, this may happen or it might not happen, or, you know, it just kind of opened up my options, I guess, rather than me expecting things to go one way. It just gave me more experiences. But I probably really internalized with COVID. I wasn't catching it with friends. Heaps of people, even my own family, didn't even see me pregnant. You guys were like my friends. Going for a chat.
That's lovely.
Yeah. So yeah, I found that really good. That's probably the biggest difference, I guess.
I'm sure the women would love to hear that, the women we've interviewed.
Oh, it's so true. You should be able to chat vaginal birth to a lot of people, but, you know, it's kind of a niche topic, isn't it? Like, Who wants to chat about having a vaginal birth?
But when you find someone who's keen, that's it. You can talk for ages.
Yeah. And so then, and obviously the midwife program was the other big difference, because I just felt like I had that one person who knew me. I gave myself permission that, okay, if anything goes wrong and I need a Caesar for whatever reason, I will be okay with that. But I want to really, you know, give this such a red hot crack. It's my last chance. You know, I want to be able to do it. And yeah, and I just felt like my midwife really understood all of that.
With the large age gap, was uterine rupture on your mind at all, or were you feeling quite comfortable?
Yeah, I felt quite comfortable. So at the start, when I mentioned request to be part of the midwife program, and I mentioned, oh, you know, because I'm at higher risk attempting a VBAC, it was really good. The initial reply was like, because there's a big gap between your Caesar and this one, that, you know, it's not really that high. So it's fairly insignificant. Like I mentioned earlier too, we've had positive experiences in hospitals with medical intervention. You know, I take my hat off to some of the ladies who pursued home births. That's amazing. And in some ways I wish that I could be in a position to do that, but I know that my husband wouldn't be trusting of that environment. And to be honest with this labor, yeah, I actually relaxed when I got to the hospital, because I didn't think about it until the day when I started going into labor overnight and I went into my bathroom, my ensuite at home now. That's where I had my really significant pregnancy loss. Like, so it just brought back, I think I couldn't relax there because it brought back memories of, you know, moving between the toilet and the shower and, you know, lots of blood on the floor. And it just, I think it took me to a place that I was probably tense. I was worried that every time I went to the toilet in this final pregnancy at home, I was, yeah, I guess looking to see if there was blood. Like, I didn't recognize the impact that had until probably that I got to hospital. And just, I didn't have any music or playlist. We just had a quiet, darkish room, and the only tool I used was my breathing, and it did work. I didn't need any intervention. So I feel like I got like a happy ending.
How far apart were your contractions when you decided to go to hospital?
I had a lot of false alarms in the days leading up to it, like particularly once I got to 40 weeks, you know, I'd say to my husband, something's changing. I've got no idea whether it means anything's going to happen tonight or in 3 days' time, but, you know, I'm certainly getting closer. So then it was the Saturday night. I started to feel like, yeah, I think these are contractions, and they're about 20 minutes apart or so. And then they started to get to maybe 15, 10 minutes apart. But I was managing them at home fine. And that kind of went, I called my mum. She was on standby as well for like a month. Called her and said, yeah, maybe do you want to come over and sleep over at our house tonight, just in case we've got to go in the middle of the night? I managed to be able to relax and kind of go to bed and sleep on and off. And, you know, I was getting up throughout the night, but about 5 o'clock, I said to my husband, oh, I might just call the hospital now and just check, what do I look for that would tell me to come in? Like, the contractions weren't kind of getting really close, but they were steady at 10 minutes apart-ish. Or anyway, I just wanted some advice. And then one of the nurses said to me, look, if you're worried that the baby hasn't moved, if you want to come in and check movements. And then once she said that, I was like sitting on the bed for an hour going, oh, crap, I don't think the baby's moved. You know, like, I was alert to that then. And then I said to my husband, oh, maybe the baby's asleep, but, you know, now that this has been said to me, I can't get out of my head that what if something's gone wrong and we're not. So we decided to go in, not because of how I was feeling in terms of contractions, but just to kind of get that reassurance. So we went in about 6 o'clock. At that point, anyway, as we got in, I said, oh, I can feel the baby moving now. Things are okay. Probably didn't need to be there until maybe 9:30 or 10-ish if I had have been listening to my body purely. And then she was born at 10 to 1. So it was pretty quick.
Wow. How did the birth unfold from the time that you got to the hospital?
A good tool I had up my sleeve was knowing how long that first labor took. So when I went into hospital, I felt like the contractions were getting pretty intense, but I was also like, okay, I've got hours of this. Like, this is a long game. I've got to pace myself. I'm going to be here till tonight. Yeah, just said, okay, I'm just going to breathe, really. And I kind of wanted up my sleeve. If I need to later on, I can consider maybe if I'd take the gas or something, but I wanted to not really think about that until much later. But as I got into hospital, and even when I had different staff members come and check me before my midwife got there, they were kind of like, are you sure you're in labor? And I said, I must have been really
calm.
Yeah. And I know when I did that calm birth course, you know, they talk about what role your partner can play. And even back then, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, they were like talking about how your husband can massage you and stuff. And I was like, nah, that doesn't work for me. I just need to like kind of, he can be there, but get in my zone and just kind of walk around and he can follow me and offer me a drink. But, you know, like that was kind of, just stay back. And that was a great feeling when they did, because they were like, my midwife, when she came in, she was like, this is great and you're doing wonderful. And at that point I was stopping to talk when I was having contractions. And anyway, I remember one of the doctors coming in and checking and saying, so can you still talk, you know, when you're having contractions? And I was like, well, yeah, but, and my husband said, that's not a good measure. Like, she'll talk through anything. So, yeah. My midwife was kind of like, look, things seem to be going good. Did you want to go home for a bit? Maybe you're not progressing that quickly. Do you want to go home and see if you relax more there? And I said, okay. But I said, maybe can we just do an exam? Because in my mind, I was like, I reckon I'm further than what they think. Yeah, they checked and I was about 5 centimeters dilated. And then they were like, okay, well, the decision's made for you because you're VBAC and things can happen quickly. We're not letting you go home now. That was about 11 a.m.
Did you have the CTG monitoring? Did they have policies around that and the cannula? Was that?
Yeah, they did. I did. I had a cannula and the monitoring. I was fine with that as long as I could move. So my midwife is really good. I wanted to go outside for a bit and then the monitoring didn't work. It didn't go that far, but she was like, fine, you go, you know, you can go outside for a bit and come back and just hook it up when you get back. I think it's kind of like, you know, what battles do you, for me, I was happy and like the end game for me was having the natural birth. And a lot of people could, you know, would look at maybe the cannula and the monitoring as too much intervention. Perhaps that would be for some people, but for me, I was like, well, if it's something that a policy that needs to be done, or it's not interfering with my ability to have the natural birth, then I was okay with it.
Yeah.
And I, as long as I could get in the shower, that was my thing with water. I wanted to be in the shower and yeah, my midwife was like, it's fine. You can do all that with the monitoring. So I was okay with it. They said to me, we might need to start talking to you about artificial rupture of membranes. And I was like, again, after listening to like your podcast and stuff, I was like, oh, I don't want to go there because then that whole cascade of intervention. And so at midday, they apparently had to have the chat and sign off on what I had requested. And at that point I said to my midwife, do I have to make a decision right now? And she goes, no, let's put it off for that decision for a couple of hours and we'll see how you go. And at that point I said, I was starting to feel things really ramping up, but maybe I wasn't letting on as much. And I said, I feel like I want to go in the shower, but I don't want to like play my trump card too early. It was midday and I was thinking, if I'm still here at 5 o'clock, I want to have the shower and I don't want to waste water by being in the shower for 5 hours.
So, you're always thinking about the environment, aren't you? It's great. Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted that balance of, I'm like, I do really want to shower, but yeah, I don't want to do it too soon because when things really amp up, that's when I know I'll need it. And so then I said, okay, like midday, I was like, okay, I'm going to have a shower. And in my head, I was like, okay, even if it's just here for a bit and then I come back out and go back in later or whatever. And then as we were in the shower, I all of a sudden kind of couldn't really talk. I couldn't find a break. I was having contractions and just kind of really like breathing really deeply, and there was a definite change in my breathing and sounds I was making. And then the midwife asked me a question and I kind of couldn't answer it. And then when I got a break, I said, this is different. What I'm feeling now is different to other stuff. And then she had a look and she was like, oh, your membranes are coming now. And then she said to my husband, let's try to move her out of the shower back into the room. It's like I could hear all this going on around me, but it was just my body was doing its own thing. And I remember thinking, good luck, guys. I reckon this is happening right here, right now. But yeah, I managed to move out of the shower into the room. And so I got there and just before she was born.
What position did you assume? Were you on all fours? What happened there?
Yeah, so we'd spoken about that, which was great, just a couple of hours before. And I said to the midwife, I want to be on all fours. That's a position I really want to try. With the monitoring then, all of a sudden a few people came into the room because baby's heart rate had dipped a lot. In hindsight, like later on, the midwife said to me, she wasn't that concerned at that moment. because she knows that can happen. But anyway, the head obstetrician came in and just in a really like friendly way, she was like, okay, Jess, time to meet baby. Hurry, you know, next contraction, I really need you to push. And they'd asked me to sit up on the bed. And even at that point, I was, I can't roll over. Like I just couldn't get my body to roll over. And I was kind of hearing this stuff and part of me was, I wasn't arguing or anything, but I was just, I don't think they're going to be able to get me where they want me because I'm just not going to be able to do it. My body had taken over and I was not able to kind of follow their instructions or requests, I guess. But anyway, I did end up then sitting when I had the obstetrician there. They were maybe getting ready for an assisted delivery, perhaps. I don't even know exactly what happened, but the kind of few moments of intensity where extra midwives were in the room and the obstetrician, and they were saying, okay, Jess, it's really time. We really need you to help us meet baby. And they were like, we need you to push now. And I said to my midwife, I can't, I'm not having a contraction. Like, you know, that urge isn't there. I can't make the push happen. But in my head, I was like, okay, I have to do this because I just, yeah, I didn't want at that point. It was in the back of my mind, will they say you need an emergency Caesar? You know, if anything happens. And fortunately, yeah, once we got baby's head out, heart rate went fine. And then the obstetrician, she said something like, wonderful, I'll leave you to it. And then they left. And I had a beautiful student midwife who is my next door neighbor's granddaughter. So she was there at the birth as well. And she had asked if I minded if she delivered the baby. And I didn't. And so once we had the head out, she said to me, Jess, do you want to touch a baby's head? And I did. And then, yeah, I had another kind of couple of pushes. And when baby came out, this young student midwife assisted baby like straight onto my chest. I didn't fully assist, but I felt by touching her head and then kind of holding onto her immediately when she was on my chest. Yeah, it was just that feeling that I so desired. I just felt so on a high, so joyful. It was just the best feeling I've ever had. It was just amazing. And then we didn't even, after a little while, people were like, do you want to find out the baby's gender? And I'm just like, no, we were like, oh, soon, but look at this perfect baby, whoever they are.
Yeah.
They're here and they're wonderful. Yeah.
That's so lovely.
That's beautiful. And it was a girl, yes?
Yes. Yeah.
You found out.
So my son's, he's got a big sister, a sister the same age, and a little sister.
Love it. I wanted to ask, did your membranes end up rupturing on their own as the head emerged?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they ruptured on their own as the head emerged. Oh, I'm so glad we didn't have that conversation about artificial rupture and none of it was needed. I didn't need to go down the path of do I request any drugs or anything. It just all just kind of went better than I could have even hoped for.
Did you have physiological third stage? Did the placenta come out in its own time or did you have the Syntocin?
Yeah, I had the Syntocin injection. That's probably one aspect. Again, I looking at your questions, I spoke to my husband last night and I kind of said, I hadn't probably got to that point. You have your kind of plan or rules or non-negotiable things. Because a lot of my pregnancy was kind of looking at, was there growth restriction and then some of the physical issues I was having and then just going over the due date and discussions then in my catch-ups were about, at what point would I consent to induction and stuff like that? Yeah, I felt that's probably an area of birth, the third stage, that I didn't have a solid plan for. And looking back, what happened on the day was I pretty much just was kind of like, I've got this unreal baby, do whatever you want. Like in hindsight now, I wish I had have had my head a bit clearer about what my thoughts were on that.
And how many weeks were you actually when you delivered?
40 and 3 days.
And but in your mind, did you have an induction date in mind or did you not want to go there?
I didn't really want to go there on the Monday. So she was born on Sunday. I had an appointment on Monday and that would have been 40 and 4. And that's when I believe we would have had that type of chat about how long would I go for. And I was just kind of hoping to set it, whether it was 41 or whatever. I was just kind of hoping that whatever date I set, I'd go into natural labour before then. But I hadn't got around to making a date yet. But it was on my mind. A lot of other women that I've heard you guys speak to, you know, get to the point where they're overdue and they advocate for going past 41 weeks and stuff like that. So it was on my mind. I wonder if I'm going to have those conversations. But, yeah, I didn't need to in the end.
How did this birth compare mentally and physically to your previous birth experiences?
Well, recovery was amazing. Even though, you know, I was home 4 hours after the birth, a lot of people were like, oh, wow, you know, why'd you do that? I read Sarah Buckley's book, Gentle Birth. I should have said that earlier. That was one of my key preparation points. I read her book and I reread sections of it and just really loved certain things that she said. You know, you kind of pick and choose which things you want to take. And yeah, I really, that was a wonderful resource. And something that she had said in that was about, you know, after the birth, still like having that respite at home. And it was funny when I was like, why did I not think that you can rest at home? You know, the first pregnancy I had, but times have really changed. Like the post-COVID world, when I had my first baby, you did just get random visitors. When I had the twins, it was like, oh, let's come around. People who I hadn't seen for ages were coming around to look at the twins. And like looking back, I should have just said, sorry, like leave us alone for a month kind of thing. Whereas, yeah, this time around, plenty of people said, because this baby was born on the 13th of December. So a lot of parents I'd seen at school or kinder drop-offs were like, you know, all the best. We'll come and catch you in the new year. You know, we'll leave you to it. You know, so people really, yeah, I found I didn't have to kind of advocate for quiet time because people were really open to giving that space. And because my other kids were older and my husband took time off, they all really loved that it was mum and the baby were up in mum's room resting and my husband got to do cool things with the big kids and they were able to help, you know, with nappy changes and cuddles and things like that. And we didn't have the stress of staying away overnight.
I wanted to find out about the physical, I guess, recovery, because you did have a vaginal birth the first time as well. You had an episiotomy, if I recall. What about this time? Did you experience any tearing with your VBAC?
No, I just can't believe it. So I had no tearing. It was actually never painful and I didn't have any tearing. You know, it just made me feel even more like in awe of the female body that I'm looking at my baby's head when she's a day old, kind of going, that baby exited my body and I've got no, my body just opened up to allow for that. Like, how amazing is that? I guess I had expectations that I would need time to recover and I certainly took that. But it's like that whole thing, you know, when we had the twins, we knew we were going to be busy because we knew what it was like with one. So rather than be disappointed at not achieving things, we set the bar pretty low. So we were excited when we did get out of the house because we weren't expecting to. So it was kind of like that this time around. I was expecting that I was kind of going to bunker down in my bedroom and not leave it and kind of be recovering as if I was, you know, in hospital, but just in my bedroom. So because I was kind of anticipating that, I ended up, when I felt fine to come outside and do some stuff in the garden or, you know, be involved in the family activities around the dinner table and stuff, that was all wonderful. All those little daily things were like wonderful bonuses rather than, yeah, because I wasn't anticipating to get back to that stuff so quickly and there was no pressure to do all that. Physically, I mean, I haven't pushed myself. She's only 11 weeks old now and I haven't tried to do anything beyond going for walks. But, yeah, I feel like I'm day-to-day functioning really well. I was obviously able to drive early on, which was really helpful. It wasn't essential, but it was helpful to have that option. Physically, so far, I haven't had any issues and I'm a bit more aware of still continuing to do pelvic floor exercises and just when I can, some kind of gentle strengthening things, whether they're like bridges lying on my back, squats and stuff like that, just functional movement type stuff. Yeah, I'm probably more diligent with doing some of those things because I'm aware I've got the curse of being a bit older now and that maybe I need.
So things like incontinence, has that been affecting you at all? If you're happy to share
it? No, it hasn't been. It hasn't been an issue. I'm aware that maybe it could be later on, but so far, no, it hasn't been. So fingers crossed. But yeah, I know a bit more now to know that my body has been through some big events, but yeah, everything seems to be okay at the moment.
Sounds wonderful. Really, yeah. So happy that you got to have this experience, and obviously a major factor in your drive for a VBAC as well was your eldest daughter and being able to be there for her. Their physicality and the ability. Then you had such a wonderful vaginal birth experience.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us and all of your personal births and losses. And we really appreciate it. I think women out there will really appreciate hearing your story also.
Oh, thanks, Steph.
And thank you for listening to us as well. It's really nice to speak to someone who sort of listened to the stories and got something from that to take into your VBAC. Yeah, it's really nice to know.
Yeah. Thank you to you guys for, you know, putting this out there, because it's definitely been a resource, particularly when, like, in the situation I was in where we were socially isolated living in Victoria and having like stage 3 and stage 4 restrictions. You know, it wasn't, you weren't getting that incidental kind of conversational chats with other friends or family members because you weren't seeing them. So, yeah, I found it a really good exercise to go for that walk. And it was kind of like, I found it was like getting my head in the game, listening to these conversations and just, yeah, hearing the way different things can pan out. And I guess talking to you guys a lot today has made me realize, I always knew it had an impact, but the experience we've been through with our eldest daughter, I think what it's taught me the most is, you know, I see her go through struggles that she has no control over. She'll be denied opportunities, you know, that are considered normal for people, whether it be possibly driving a car. I don't know if her vision will allow for things like that, or just even participation in daily activities, playing with her friends. Her disability impacts that. And she's getting to an age where she asks why her and things like that. So that's kind of hard emotionally to answer at times. But I think it also gave me that real drive in this pregnancy that I was like, if my young daughter has to go through, you know, hard things, then I can also do hard things. And my body, fortunately, doesn't have any limitations on it. So if I respect my body and I look after it and I fuel it with the right foods and hydration and I don't abuse my body, then it can do what it's meant, what I'm lucky enough to have the opportunity for it to do. So, yeah, I guess she just impacts my life in every day in really good ways.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Like your attitude and your perspective, it's really inspirational.
If we didn't live in Australia and like having access to that free public health, we've met people since, like families from around the country would go to Melbourne or Sydney for any pediatric care that's, you know, so to have them as your local, I just, the amount of times we drive to Melbourne, it's just 2 hours and we're just like, oh, we're so lucky that we live this close to the best people. Seeing your kids be so resilient, I think just only makes you, it sounds cliche, but you really do appreciate just when we got home from the hospital with our eldest daughter, my mum had been around to my house. My dad came to Melbourne to drive us home because he just figured we'd be tired. And I still remember it so clearly, like mum had opened up all the curtains in the house and I just felt like this spring freshness and just, I just had this overwhelming sense of I'm home in my house now, the sun's shining, I can feel the breeze in the air. I just became alert at a level that I'd never been before. And I don't know whether that was becoming a parent or becoming a parent to a kid who's going to go through things. I don't know. But, yeah, it definitely makes you see the world in a different way. So in that way, it kind of a blessing. That's not the right, I don't know, it's not the right word. I mean, there's plenty of good that comes from tough situations is what I mean.
No, yeah, you're right. Well, thank you so much. Love hearing your inspirational journey.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.